Well, good morning, friends, brothers and sisters. I want you to know God. I want you to know Christ. For that aim, this is not necessarily the passage I would pick if I were just starting from scratch with our New Testament bias these days, but it's all here, as you'll see, or as I pray you'll see. So we're going to be in 1 Samuel 23 today. Kind of a weird story for us. The holier term for that is challenging. It's a challenging story. It's odd. And as you read it, it might seem like more of the same. David's on the run, Saul's doing bad things, David has bad things happening to him. It might seem like more of the same, and that's it. But as Pastor Doug Wilson has said, in this chapter, things get thicker, clearer. The lines get drawn more clearly, the stakes are higher, and we know that happens repeatedly with life in this world. Things ramp up as you go. There's a theme in this, and I've briefly alluded to this before. This comes from a Hebrew scholar named Robert Alter. But there's a theme running throughout this section particularly, and really the whole book of 1 Samuel, but this section particularly. The theme, and you'll see it in relation to the title immediately, the theme is that David has perfect access to God. Perfect access, a direct line to God's knowledge. You'll see it as we read. Where should I go? And God tells him where to go and what to do. He has a direct access. He's in the loop, you might say, whereas Saul is in the dark. He's left out. Doesn't know what he needs to know. He is perpetually chasing knowledge that forever eludes him, forever remains one step out of his grasp, just as David himself does. So this theme of who has perfect knowledge, divine knowledge, and who doesn't. And we're going to see all of that on steroids, as it were, in this chapter. So David's continual fleeing from Saul, we're going to see the divine revelation that David has. What should I do? And God reveals it to him. Revelation. Second, a note about the rejection David experiences by the people in this chapter. And then this brilliant picture of division at the end, the rock of division, this real dividing point that things come to. So, knowing God, divine revelation, human rejection, the rock of division. 1 Samuel 23, 1 through 29. Now they told David, and this is right after that massacre at Nob that we looked at before of the priests. They told David, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, an Israelite border town. Israelites are fighting against Keilah and are robbing the threshing floors. Therefore, David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah.' But David's men said to him, 'Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more than if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?'" Translation: it's bad enough when just Saul is fighting us. If you add in Philistines plus Saul fighting us, like, what sense does that make? And so then David inquired of the Lord again. And just one more insertion here, you might say, well, the first time David just asked if they should go. He didn't actually ask if they should win. So here if they would win. So here he clarifies the matter. Inquired of the Lord again, and the Lord answered him, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand." And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines and brought away their livestock and struck them with a great blow. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. When Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, had fled to David to Keilah, he had come down with an ephod in his hand. We'll explain that in a minute. It was told Saul that David had come to Keilah. And Saul said, "God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars. He's trapped. He won't be able to escape this time." And so Saul summoned all the people to war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him. And he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." Then David said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, your servant has surely heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord, the God of Israel, please tell your servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down." Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will surrender you." Then David and his men, who were about 600, arose and departed from Keilah. And they went wherever they could go. When Saul was told that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the expedition. And David remained in the strongholds, in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not give him into his hand. David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God, encouraged him. And he said to him, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. I know it, I'm certain. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul my father also knows this." And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. Then the Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hakkelah, which is south of Jeshimon, or the wasteland? Now come down, O king, according to all your heart's desire to come down, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." And Saul said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, for you have had compassion on me," or felt sorry for me. "Go, make yet more sure, know, and see the place where his foot is, and who has seen him there, for it is told me that he is very cunning. See, therefore, and take note of all the lurking places where he hides, and come back to me with sure information. Then I will go with you, and if he is in the land, I will search him out among all the thousands of Judah." And they arose and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon, or the wasteland. And Saul and his men went to seek him. David was told it. So he went down to the rock and lived in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. And Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul. And Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture them. A messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land." So Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore, that place was called the Rock of Escape. And David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. This is the word of the Lord. First, you see it throughout the chapter, right? David has direct line to divine knowledge. It's access to God. Are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? Should we do this or should we do that? Should we stay or go or attack? And God tells him, he answers him every time. David has insider knowledge, whereas Saul is a bit clueless. He knows some things, but not enough. He's in the dark. All right. Verse 7, he knows David is in Keilah. He knows it. By the time he gets there, David's gone. Second half of 14, he is pursuing David endlessly, but never catching up to him or getting him, such that by the time you get to that line, in 19 through 22, by the time you get to the Ziphites coming and telling Saul unprovoked, unrequested, "Hey, he's with us, we'll turn him over to you, we'll give him into your hands," it's meant to be almost comical, I believe. I mean, they come and tell him, "He's right here. We know it. David is in such and such a place." And the string of names they give is very specific. Way more specific than most descriptions in biblical narrative. "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of..." They know the hill he's on, right? They know the rock he is sitting on. It's south of that wasteland we all know about. What, they know exactly where he is. What does Saul say? "Go and find out for sure." "I need to know better. Go and make yet more sure. There's not enough information yet. I've done all this before," and he keeps on escaping. "Come back to me with more sure information, then I'll go." What a contrast between the two. The one thing, and bringing it down in the reading, the one thing Saul knows throughout the chapter is that David will be king in front of him, in place of him. And he rejects that. It's the source of all of his other problems. You reject the one thing God gives you, you're going to always be looking for more. Saul has deprived himself of priestly knowledge. He has slaughtered them all. You remember this from 22. David in the wilderness and a new Israel is forming around him. Prophet, priest, all there. He has insider knowledge. He has access to divine revelation. Now, you might be saying, and it would be perfectly fair if you do, and I hope that you are at some level, yeah, it would be nice if I could do that. It would be nice if I had some kind of means, some mechanism for asking God, is this or that going to happen? Just, there's the answer. That would be convenient, wouldn't it? How exactly is David getting that? All right, so let's talk about the ephod for a minute. Seems the best way to understand verse 6 is that it is retrospective. It's looking backwards. It's not a new development in the story, but rather Abiathar has come to David. He's brought the ephod. We move on to the next event, Keilah. And now as an explanatory aside, looking back, this is how David is asking all these questions, getting answers. He has the priest with the ephod. There are other possibilities, but that seems to me to be the best. And if you're curious about the other possibilities, come ask me afterwards. We'll take the time here. But so he has the priest with the ephod. Well, what's the ephod? On the one hand, an ephod was simply the linen garment that any priest wore. Remember that in 22, that all these 85 priests who are wearing the ephod, linen garment, uniform for the priest. On the one hand. On the other hand, there was the ephod, singular. The one ephod worn by the great high priest. And that one ephod, you can read about this in Exodus 28, that one ephod had two things in it called the Urim and the Thummim. The Urim and Thummim. And we don't know exactly what they were. Begg and Woodhouse have said the emphasis of the Bible, and they're right on this, the emphasis of the Bible is on the fact and the content of God's revelation to these individuals, not on the means by which it happens. That's not the Bible's emphasis. So we don't know exactly what the mechanism was. There's likely a mercy in that. Otherwise, think how many of us would be trying to replicate whatever the Urim and Thummim were. That way we can do the exact same thing. No, that's not the point. We don't know exactly what it was, but it seems like it was some kind of casting of lots deal, throwing dice. You remember this from back in chapter 14, when the ancestor to Abiathar is serving Saul, and they're going to go on this expedition. They're going to chase down the Philistines, and the priest, Abiathar's grandfather, says, you should inquire of the Lord. And he's got the ephod there. And so Saul asks, should we go or not? And there's no answer. Then later on, there's the whole rundown of Saul and Jonathan. Is it the people or is it my family? Lot gives that it's his family. And then is it Jonathan or is it me? And the lot falls, the dice fall perhaps to Jonathan. It's a means of giving binary answers to yes or no questions. And so when these Urim and Thummim are rolled, your options are yes, affirmative, no, negative, or not clear. The parody of the Magic 8-Ball, try again later. And I'm not endorsing the Magic 8-Ball at all, right? But yes, no, or try again, unclear. And you see here in this chapter, all the questions and answers are binary. Is he going to do this or are they going to do that? Yes or no, and the answers keep coming back, yes or no. And this is not some hocus pocus thing. This is not the occult. This is divine sanctioned. Exodus 28, whatever the exact means were, David has a priest with him. And so he has perfect knowledge of what God wants him to know. Samuel, treatise on what a Messiah is. What is a Messiah? Who is a Messiah? It's one who walks step by step in perfect knowledge with the plan of the Father. That's what it is. And David has that. Now, the thing, and of course you see that with Christ, right? When Jesus comes, the Messiah, perfect step with the will of the Father. Everywhere. Always in the will of God. And the thing is, it's not just meant for Jesus. It's also meant for every single one of us who are in Christ. that we too are to walk in line with, in accordance with, knowing the will of God for our lives. Knowing God in our lives. It's meant for you. Deuteronomy chapter 4, it's meant for the people of God. Deuteronomy chapter 4, Moses says, when God did all these things, bringing us out of Egypt, has it ever happened that a people had a God do such great things as for us? The signs, the wonders, the deliverance. He says, why did God do all that for us? Answer, so that you would know God. Know, therefore. It's the Christ, but it's not just the Christ, it's also the whole people of the Christ, that they would know God. It's meant for you. Isaiah 30:21. Isaiah prophesying the filling of the Spirit in the age of the Messiah. Your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, whether you turn to the right or to the left, this is the way, walk in it. And you get to Acts chapter 1 and 2. The people of God, it's not just the Old Testament, it's not just the prophecies, New Testament, us, our age, the church, people of God. You know, Acts chapter 1, I've said this before, Acts 1 is the last time that the people of God are recorded as casting of lots in the Bible. Right? Oh, it'd be nice if we had that Old Testament means that we could know God, just ask a question, boom, here's the answer. No. Acts 1 is the last time the people of God throw lots. It's for the replacement of Judas. Why is it the last time that they throw lots in Acts 1? Why? Because what's Acts chapter 2? Pentecost. The filling of the Holy Spirit. Your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way. And in 1 Corinthians 2, in Paul's great chapter on the Holy Spirit, he concludes by saying, these things cannot be, worldly man can't know it, Saul. These things cannot be discerned by the worldly man, for they are of the Spirit, but we have the mind of Christ. You're meant to know God like this. This is intended for you. Now here's the other thing. As great as the ephod was, that's not the only means God uses, even here. Because look at the rest of the chapter. God also uses fellow human beings. What do you have right in the middle? Center of the chapter, a familiar face reappears. And this will be the last time he and David meet. Maybe the unsung hero of the book of 1 Samuel, Jonathan. You could even understand the entirety of chapter 23 as a great chiasm around Jonathan and his covenant with David. In danger from the Philistines, Keilah betrays. In danger from Saul, Ziph betrays. Center, Jonathan. No. Don't fear. Just like Casey said last week. Presence of faith doesn't mean the absence of fear. David is a man of faith. He's walking with God. God knows he needs reassurance why he's afraid. And God says, Jonathan, know for certain. It's not just the ephod. It's other people. There have been two times. You see, there have been two times in the 13 years that Daniel and I have been married when we faced a major life decision and both of our fathers independently came to us and said, respectfully, right? You are your own people. We recognize you're adults. You have to do your own thing, make your own mistakes. So respectfully, but as far as we can see, whatever wisdom we can pass on, both of our dads came to us independently and said, don't do this. With all the wisdom we have to offer, life experience, this is not wise for you. One was with the purchase of the house that we're now in, and another house we were looking at buying instead. A second was with a major decision that had to happen with seminary. And when we went through the house buying process, one of the verses we prayed regularly was the one I quoted you from Isaiah, Isaiah 30:21, whether you turn to the right or to the left, you'll hear a voice saying, this is the way, walk in it. And when, as we were praying that, it wasn't that we like had this audible voice, you know, and you walk into the showing and the hallelujah chorus starts playing, and they're like, oh, this is it. No. How did God answer the prayer? Both our dads saying, this isn't what you need. And it was a house that was too small. It was too old and run down. Some of you have the fixer upper. Gene, we don't. Our dads know that. Don't do that. This is not wise. We thought they would be proud of us for being willing to put up with less. And they said, no. There's something else. And even, I mean, our dads have totally different temperaments. If just one of them had come to us, we maybe would have listened. We maybe would have gone our own way. In fact, both of them did it. And it happened again with a seminary decision elsewhere. When David is in the woods and needs encouragement, as Wilson has said, God doesn't send spiritual happy vibes. You'll feel better. He sends Jonathan, a man, a friend, an older man. God didn't send a generic spirit of contentment to David. He sent Jonathan. And in order for that to happen, Jonathan had to be willing to go, meant risks for him. He had to be willing to speak what he knew to others. And in order for that to happen, it meant David had to recognize the leading of God in the words of Jonathan. It's the same with us. To talk about the Spirit leading you doesn't mean you will always have this infallible inner impression, but rather in the community of faith, through his word, he will direct your path. So may we be interested. I mean, and then down in 25, right? Later, David was told, it's an anonymous scout. He doesn't even get named. He's bringing a report. He's giving David knowledge that God knew he needed to have. Come through other people, as well as the overt, miraculous means. So may you and I be means of affirming and revealing the knowledge of God in the lives of one another. And may we experience that in the revelation given to us in the lives of other believers. Now, that's the first thing. Here's the second. David's access to revelation, all that he has, notice, still doesn't mean life is going to be easy, right? Here's the second thing. What's it mean to be a Messiah? One, 1 Samuel 23, one, you walk step by step in the perfect will of God. Two, second thing, to be a Messiah is to be rejected by the very people you came to save. Be rejected by your very own. The ones you came to save, and they look at you and they scorn you. That's what it means, too. David has just saved Keilah, right? They were oppressed by the Philistines. Philistines were squatting on their land, taking their grain, taking their livestock. Who knows what else they were doing? Their own government is doing nothing to deliver them. Same time, Saul is killing Nob. Philistines are attacking Keilah. He's not protecting them. Taken up with hunting down his own enemies. Keilah's being absolutely oppressed. David rescues, seemingly without even being asked by them. Saul now comes. Are they going to hand me over? Yep. What gives? And before we give Keilah too hard of a time, remember, they would have had good reason, humanly speaking, for doing this. Remember Nob. David does. He doesn't want another city destroyed on his account, verse 10. Doesn't want that to happen. But still, they're clearly in the wrong, right? They're clearly wrong. This man has just saved them. He's the Lord's Christ. What they do is petty. It's cowardly. And they do it because they have fear of destruction. If we don't, Saul's going to do to us what he just did to the priests. To Nob, fear of destruction, they hand him over. And then what happens down in 19? Ziph, the Ziphites, at least some of them, hand him over. This time David is just hiding out, and they go seemingly and volunteer. Oh, Saul, why would they do it? Maybe it's fear of destruction for them as well, but also seemingly fear of or a desire of reward. The things that Saul has listed out in 22. I will give whoever hands him over to me this, this, and this. Even if they don't have the specifics of what he has offered, they have the general premise. And so they hand him over. Fear of destruction, desire of reward. And the key thing is both of these towns were towns in Judah. You remember the tribe David is of and the whole tribal division at that time. If anybody should have stood by David, it should have been these guys. And they hand him over. His own, he came to that which was his own. And his own received him not. Nature of a Messiah. Right? So these two miss out on David and walking in the knowledge with God that he provides. So they're not having the knowledge that they should have. And again, before we give them too hard of a time, I mean, is there any way that we do this in a contemporary setting? Any ways that people today, that we reject the Lord's Christ out of fear of destruction or desire for reward elsewhere? Any ways we do? See, take any hobby. There's a student minister when I was in college at our church, who who used to say that he'd walk around, his days were filled with meetings with students, and in between appointments he would have all this free time, 20 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And he said, as he thought about his days, the thing that most kept him from growing closer to God was ESPN. Because 10 minutes here, 20 minutes there, commune with God explicitly or check the scores. The thing that most kept him growing closely with God was ESPN. I think he's on to something. So take any hobby that we have, not wrong in and of themselves. We are meant to be in the world and not of it. And so while we're not of the world, we are to be in it. So do hobbies. And participating in human cultural activity is why God put us on the earth. So they're good. But what I'm getting after is, if we get to the point where I don't have time for this or that fellowship group or spiritual growth group or endeavor, but I got these three or four or five other things going on, well, there's probably an issue there. And the issue is there is some lesser king that person is trying to satisfy. The hobby is not the king, but it is the occasion for the king to manifest himself. And it's different things for different people. All right, so picture whatever your hobby is for you or for your kids. I'm going to go with badminton. A badminton league, just so I'm not singling anybody out. But as I say badminton, you just plug in whatever you're. I don't think we have too many people in a badminton league here. All right. So as you hear badminton, just plug in your thing. Take three different people who do a badminton league in place of any kind of spiritual growth endeavor. There are different reasons why they do it. Some person can do it for comfort or entertainment. Another person does it for control. A third person does it for affirmation or acceptance or approval. First person, badminton is not so much, the rest of the week is hard. Badminton is a chance to have simply a good time. Just unwind and relax, kick back. The rest of the week's hard, here's where I enjoy myself. You're pleasing the lesser king of comfort, entertainment. Another person does badminton for control. Whether it's the chance to control you or your kid's career trajectory, if we do this, this, and this, we get the scholarship and they're off and running. Control long term, or even just the more immediate, the rest of my week feels out of whack, but I know Tuesday nights, 6:30, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna play with my friends. It's gonna be nice. I know when I serve like this, the shuttlecock does that. I'm in control. And you're feeding it. Third person does it for acceptance, approval. When I'm with this group, I belong. I'm reasonably good at it, decent at it. So they like me. They accept me. Three different people doing the exact same hobby, three totally different things going on in their heart, and yet each one follows the pattern of, if I do this, I keep this good, this God, this king happy. Of course, we don't call it a God or a king, but if I keep this happy, I'll get the rewards and pleasures and benefits I want. And if I don't, I'll face destruction. My life won't be what I want it to be. It's desire for reward. It's fear of destruction. You can do it with careers. You can do it with relationships. You can do it with your bank account. You can do it with all kinds of things. But it's what a picture in these two cities. Rejecting the Lord's Christ out of wanting benefits elsewhere, or fearing if you don't please somewhere, some other area, your life won't be what you want it to. It's a sinful pattern on perfect display in Keilah and Ziph. Now, if all that's the case, and if all that's true, and it is, then what on earth do you do? If it's true that you were made to know God, and one came to lead you into that perfect knowledge of God in your life, and in your sin you reject the very one who came to restore you to that, then how on earth can you be saved? How on earth can you be brought back to that knowledge of God? 3. There's an amazing picture at the end of the chapter. You know what En Gedi is down in the very last verse, verse 29? You know what En Gedi is? It's an oasis. That means when it says David took his men to En Gedi, it's not just a geographical note. It's saying Saul went this way, David went that way, and where David went, he gave those who were with him water and bread, food, provision and refreshment in the wilderness. He's providing for his people. This chapter is piling up terms for the deprivation and privation of life. The wilderness, the wasteland, the desert, the forest, even the mountain, if you want to include that. Piling up all these terms, and yet in the midst of all that, oasis, provision by the Anointed One. So David ends up at the oasis, but the way that he gets there is this amazing picture in 26. Saul's on one side of the mountain, David's running on the other, right? David's been in Maon, Saul comes, advanced scouts from Ziph, David finds out about it, so he goes, Saul chases. Amazing picture, going on one side of the mountain and the other. And living where we do, we can picture this very vividly. Growing up where many of us have, I remember as a boy in Fulton County, our family rented this farmhouse and there were rolling hills and sprawling fields. And the kind of fields that when you go back and visit now, they don't seem that big. But as a kid, man, they seem like they were the world. And I remember, and even now on hikes in this area, I remember being in those hills and imagining what they would have been like in the Civil War or the Revolutionary War. And you crest and they're just all these hundreds or thousands of men or soldiers just right there out of sight to the mountains. One on one side, one on the other. And it's not in the text per se, but it's been suggested, it's fairly plausible, that what Saul does here as he's going on one side is what you might call a pincer movement, where he splits his troops and half are going on the other side of the mountain, the other half are circling back and coming behind David to keep driving him forward so that as these two are driving and moving, they're leading David into a very narrow squeeze, a tight space, a shaft, a vice grip, the tightest of spaces. He's going to be squeezed out. And at the very last second, just when you think the story's about to end at 1 Samuel chapter 23, at the very last second, a messenger comes. And it's just like the Assyrians with Hezekiah. Oh, king, you're needed elsewhere. There's another threat, another invader. And Saul has to call it off and leave. And so Saul's troops go one way, and David escapes. And so that place is called the Rock of Escape, but the word there that is used usually means division. The Rock of Division, of dividing, of splitting apart. The reason why it is David's escape is because that's the place where they parted ways. And so the third thing, 1 Samuel 23 gives us that a Messiah is, it's to walk step in step with knowledge of God, it's to be rejected by your own, and third, it is to be lifted up and preserved after walking into the narrowest, the tightest of squeezes, even apparently certain death, nature of a Messiah. And you see, all that brings you to a point of decision yourself. You're going to come to a moment. You have come to a moment. Will you go this way? There's a divide. Will you go this way? Or will you go that way? Because there was another time when another Messiah came and he walked in perfect step with knowledge of the will of the Father. And though he did, he was rejected by men, even rejected by his own. And God, through that rejection, God led him into the narrowest of traps. And that time, God did not get the Messiah out at the last possible second, but let him go through with it. Let him go through it in full and bear the brunt, certain death, only to raise him up again on the other side. And why did God the Father have that Messiah go through it and not pull him out at the end? Because you see, that time the Messiah was bearing the weight, the cost of your rejection of him. And even God was using your very rejection of him, as well as the Jews, his own people, using the very rejection of him to twist it around and bring about your salvation. That him paying the penalty for it in full would lead you out of it so that when you see him going down into the tightest of spaces, your choice is, you can go with the one, the lesser king, who in the eyes of the world looks like he'll give you everything you long for. He'll give it to you all the material benefits. Your life won't be destroyed. Please, this area. You can go that way, or you can look at Jesus Christ and join him in denying yourself. This is the language in the Sermon on the Mount of the narrow road. It's the tight squeeze. It's certain death. It's going down the squeeze of laying down love for self and love of the world. God, the self-giving God, cannot fill a heart that is consumed with pleasing itself. They're opposites. But if you look at Jesus Christ going through that squeeze for you and you join him in the death of self-denial, well, you'll experience his provision in the wilderness of this life. Living water, eternal bread, most of all, knowing God himself.